First of all, I would like to thank the organizer to give me this opportunity. I'm very glad to talk about the topological insulators, or more generally, topological effects from a condensed matter point of view, which seem related to many concepts also in high energy physics. Although this is not ADS, not a CFT, and not a correspondence, but I mean, we'll see, it may be related to this topic of this workshop later. And what's this? Just follow Senke's way that if you remember one sentence from my talk, there will be massive fermions, generally topological term. Yeah, so all these are about this massive fermion. And so here is an outline. So as an example, let's start from the 2+1 dimensional quantum Hall effect, which is the most well-known topological phenomena, which we understand well. But, and I will focus on the case, which is very simple. It's just integer quantum Hall effect. So that will be related to, as we know, they're related to transcendence theory and also the Chern number in the momentum space. And also it's related to the 1+1 dimensional chiral anomaly. So then the interesting thing is that this is related to another topological phenomenon in 1+1 dimension, which is adiabatic charge pumping, where when you tune some parameter to pump charge. And then we will see why we have some formalism called the phase space transcendence theory, and how that describes this and that. And then we generalize this to high dimensions where that relate to like 3+1 dimensional chiral fermions, and that's also related to this newly discovered topological insulator in 3+1 dimensions, which has a FYJF term in its effective theory. And then we will discuss about the general generalization of all these to generic dimensions. So let's start from the 2+1D case. So basically what this sentence means, you know, in an equation will be you have a action of a fermion, and that fermion minimally coupled to a gauge field, and for our purpose we can just consider that gauge field to be U1. So just like I have an electron coupled to my electromagnetic field, and in the 2+1, it's like in a 2D electron gas. And then I integrate out my electron. So I get an effective theory of my gauge field. So I don't consider dynamics of the gauge field, it's just a source. So and then we are especially interested in the topological terms here. So now in 2+1 dimensions, we know the topological term is a transcendence term. So the effective theory has a transcendence term generically with some coefficient, which for some reason I will call it C1 over 4 pi and plus other term. So then the question is what's the coefficient of this term, which is the propagator of the gauge field generated from the fermion? And the question is, how do we obtain that from fermion? And now we just consider fermion to be non-interacting. So this is a very simple calculation, and it's just a bubble diagram, which means you have a current-current correlation. So this gives the coefficient of this is given by the current-current correlation with the frequency. But then if we are interested in this term, let's, for example, if we take partial to be the zeros to partial to the time, then one special term in this transcendence term is AI partial 0 AJ, epsilon IJ. So that I'm basically saying that the coefficient of the transaction term is just Hawk and Acton. I mean, so what you need to do is you pick up the term in this propagator, which is proportional to epsilon mu nu tau q tau times this coefficient plus some other term, so that I have this T1, which is just partial q tau of this correlation function. Which usually we just have like this over omega, and in the low energy limit we just take a limit and that's the Kruger formula. So then the interesting thing happens that this turns out to be, I mean, for a free fermion, if the fermion is gapped, this turns out to be a topological term. Means, I mean, this average value is taken in the free fermion. And if the fermion is gapped, you can see that no matter what's the detail of your band structure, you always get a topological expression, which is a Chern number. Yeah, so to see that, we can, there is one nice way to see that why this is a topological environment. So the current is basically partial Hamiltonian, partial the corresponding, now I define the Hamiltonian, let's say. So the Hamiltonian is the second quantized Hamiltonian, but so I have, for the free fermion, I have a single particle Hamiltonian, which is just a function of momentum. So now I take, now the current operator is basically, in the long wavelength limit, it's partial the momentum. Oh, sorry, this is momentum space. Yeah. So I mean, then you calculate this J mu, J nu, and this expression, then that can be written in a way that it integrates over three Qs, include the omega and the frequency and the momentum, and then it becomes P inverse partial mu T, P inverse partial mu T. Inverse partial tau t, epsilon mu nu tau. That's because g inverse is this h here. g is like is the Green function, which is like omega minus h p, something like that. So that you can take derivative to h, which is just take derivative to g inverse, and then that can become this kind of nice symmetric form. So then you can see that this is when you put this epsilon tensor here, then this is a topological environment. Usually do Euclidean, but this topological term actually doesn't matter. You mean where? I may have an overall. Oh, this one. Yeah. Sorry. This one. Yeah, basically you see here you have a current correlation, and then so each current I write in partial G inverse partial Q mu, but then I have Green function in between, and then I partial the whole thing, partial another Q, then you do you see there are three derivatives and become this, but yeah, there is a reference about this. There's a work by Goldman, which it's physics letter B. Yeah, about this kind of expression. Yeah, so then this is to show that it's not a surprise that we get a topological expression. And then you can simplify this because the frequency dependence is very simple, and you can simplify this and finally only leave this momentum integral. And then this, what is this fxy? So the fxy is the Berry phase curvature, and Berry phase curvature is defined as I consider this single particle Hamiltonian HP as a as like a single set Hamiltonian and P as a parameter. I mean, you can diagonalize your Hamiltonian P is a good Kolmogorov number. And if you consider P as a parameter, then you change that parameter adiabatically that obtain a barrier phase. Right? So the eigenspace of this Hamiltonian is like this. And then if I consider P as a parameter, then you can define a connection. So these are the single particle wave functions. N is the band level. Yeah, so if you have two bands, you have 1 to 2. And then you can define, in general, the non-abelian gauge curvature, which is ANM in the momentum space, and that's minus I partial P, PI. Yeah. So now this is only momentum, no frequency. So this is the generic definition of the barrier phase connection. And then you can show that so this calculation lead to integral of the curvature, and that's the U1 part. It's just the sum over all the terms, epsilon ij, partial iaj. But it should be noticed that you sum only sum the occupied bands. Which means, so in general, this Hamiltonian, when I diagonalize it, I get some dispersion. For example, if it's a Dirac model, if it's a relative cavitic fermion, then you get this. You get this kind of band structure, if it has mass. So then we consider the case where chemical potential is in the gap, so that the occupied bands contribute to the Hall connection. To the coefficient of that term. So then we see this is the reason why the Hall connections of a gap system is always integer for non-interacting fermion system. And it doesn't depend on whether you have lambda levels or you have an external magnetic field. This is just generically true for any massive fermion where you have a gap on the Fermi level. This is pointed out by TK and Solis. Yeah, 1982. Yeah. This has a exactly. Yeah, you can write this as a trace of F. And the trace only pick the abelian part, which means the first number always only carry the abelian part. And PRL, yeah. So soon after the quantum Hall is discovered, this is shown that you generally have the topological quantization. Yeah. Here? Yes. Probably the easier way is you don't use this expression. The easier way is you just use this Kugel formula. From this to that. Yeah, we show that in the appendix of our paper, and the way to show that, so the easiest, I mean, in general there are many terms, but the way to simplify it is because this is a topological term. So we can topologically deform the band to flat. Means as long as your chemical potential is here, it doesn't matter. You do something far away from chemical potential, and then this term is invariant because it's topologically invariant. So you can deform all the bands to flat. All these entities are -1, +1, and then the Green function only depend on the projection operator to the ground state, to the occupied band. And then you can show that this is equal to the barrier curvature. And that proof actually goes for all the other higher dimensions. So I forgot to write down the reference of our work.
Sorry?
no, that derivative is to the wave function. All the derivatives are to wave function. Yeah. I mean, if the band is not flat, then there will be derivative to wave function, there will be derivative to moment to the band. But you just simplify because the derivative band finally will drop out. Doesn't matter. Yeah, I mean, if you study quantum spin Hall, it's like, yeah. I mean, in the quantum Hall, it's just sum the Schoen number of every band. Yeah. But more generally, we'll see that it's the non-abelian work enters once you go to the second Schoen number. Yeah. So just to be explicit, I would like to an example of this quantum Hall, which will be helpful later. I mean, we know the example is just apply a magnetic field, but as a theoretical model, that's not the simplest example because in that case you have a like continuum model, but we know there is a lattice model, it's just two bands that can give you the Hall connecting, can give you a non-trivial Schoen number, and that you can just write down the Dirac model in 2+1, which is 2+2. And that's the Hamiltonian is basically sigma x kx plus sigma y ky plus sigma z times the mass. And then I regularize that on the lattice. And then you need to put this Wilson mass term, the momentum dependence of the mass term. So that you lift all the other doubling numbers doubling partners. Otherwise, you have in your brain zone you have four Dirac points. So now for this you can ignore all other three and the dispersion is like this. And I mean, if you take the mass to be close to two, so that this there is only one Dirac cone which is close to massless. And then you can easily show that the Schoen number in this case is has a very explicit expression. This curvature has an explicit expression which is just a winding number of some d dot partial x d dot partial y d divided by maybe two or four pi. So this d vector is just the three coefficients. M as a function of k. Otherwise, you see that the energy spectrum is this. So m squared plus sine squared kx plus sine squared ky. If you don't include that term, then the energy spectrum is this. And then when m goes to zero, there are simultaneously four Dirac cones at k equal to zero pi, ky equal to zero pi. And that in that case, you will, I think you will get zero. Your calculation number will get zero. And that's because the four Dirac cones cancel each other. So then you use this to lift the degeneracy between them. So that when m, let's say when m close to two, there is only one. So when m equal to two, there is one massless, and the other three is still massless. You draw the energy spectrum of m equal to two, then you see this is zero. You draw m equal to minus two, then you see the other is zero. This is zero. This is pi. Yeah. So this is just to pick one Dirac cone. Yeah, exactly. That's because there is no Fermion doubling problem in 2+1 dimension. Because in 3+1 or 1+1, you have this Nielsen-Nino-Mia theorem, no-go theorem. But in 2+1, if you don't require time reversal symmetry, then there is no requirement, and you can't have single Dirac cone. Yeah. So why this has a non-trivial winding number is because if we go back to the continuum limit, you expand this into like kx, ky, m minus k squared, then you will see that this in the momentum space is a skirmion, if m is positive. Because the, let's say k equal to 0, then this vector is to the z direction, because for k equal to 0, this is just 0, 0, m. And for k is very large, this go to the south pole. Yeah, the Hamiltonian is sigma dot d. Yeah. And this d hat is this divided by the absolute, it's just the normal vector. Yeah. And that's well defined because it's gapped, actually. If d norm goes to 0, then you're gapless. So you see this d vector in the momentum space goes like this. Because when k is large, this is dominant is 2, so you go to the south pole. When k is small, you go to the north pole. So that's why you have a winding number 1 in this example. And that gives you the true number. Okay, so the last thing I would like to, last two things. So one thing is this effective action. So now since we have derived this coefficient, so we know the effective action. And the effective action is just this coefficient times the integral of the Baryk curvature. So this is the coefficient, and then the transaminase term. Let me just write simply in this way. So then you see that there are some similarity. I mean, this is the Baryk curvature. These are, this is also a curvature, but this is, right. Yeah. So then formally, I mean, just formally, we can see this is actually, I mean, well, you can actually write this in the five-dimensional phase space. It's just a formal, I mean, for now it's just formal. Means I define the capital A and small a, both in the phase space, which contains space, time, and momentum. And that's trivial in this case, because A only lives in the three-dimensional subspace, and the small a of the curvature lives in the other two dimensions. They are orthogonal to each other. So if you write down the transaminase term in that five-dimensional space, like this, a wedge dA wedge dA, and plus an abelian term, well, there is no abelian term because there is only one dA, and the capital A is abelian. So if you write this, this is equivalent to that. And we'll see later that this is actually non-trivial in other cases. So we don't have frequency. We have energy. We have momentum and space time. Kx, ky, and space time. Okay. Yeah. So the last thing to mention is that the boundary theory of quantum Hall has a chiral anomaly, and that can be seen from the bulk also. And I will just briefly say that because I guess most people know. So quantum Hall, so we know that the reason why we see the quantum Hall effect is that there are these edges. And if we only look at one edge, then the edge has a chiral dispersion. For the integer quantum Hall, it's just a free fermion, and but only one branch. Mm-hmm. So everything moves to the same direction. And then, so what's the relation of this bulk transaminase to the boundary anomaly? That can be seen by looking at the equation of motion. So in the bulk you have the equation of motion. You take derivative of that transaminase term. So the transaminase term is integral of AYTA. So now we go back to the real space. We don't use, so there is a true number here. And then you take derivative, you get something like this, which just tell you the quantum Hall effect. And that means if you apply electric field in this direction, EY, then you get a JS. Right. But if we leave on the boundary, we don't know the bulk, then you will see that something flows. Like if you leave here, then there is, when there is an electric field, then something flows into the bulk. So you will see some particle is missing. So the edge theory, it looks like charge conserved, because if you write down the H theory, it's chiral in the momentum space, it's just this. So it looks chiral from zero, right? But it's actually not, because when you couple it to gauge field, and then you, when you have a electric field along the 1D direction, then you get partial mu j mu equal to 1 over 2 pi times m. And that means it's not conserved. So we see that the anomaly is just actually just a quantum Hall effect in the box. And that's called Kaliner-Harvey effect in the high energy. So yeah. So then now let's go to, so that's it for the quantum Hall. So now let's go to the 1+1. I don't mean this boundary 1+1. I mean, this 1+1 is related to that 2+1, and the simple way to understand the relation is basically you compactify the other dimension. Like I have that Dirac model, that model is defined on a lattice because you have sine cosine. So it's defined on a 2D lattice. And if I compactify one direction, this is just simplest dimensional reduction, then you go to 1+1 D model. And then what? Then the interesting thing happens there is that the same calculation, the same way that you integrate out the fermion and then you get a topological term, induce the topological term here, and that's a different physical phenomenon. So to see that, let's take an example of that model. So that model has a HK equal to sigma x. So if we compactify one direction and we compactify it with a flux in this direction, call it theta. And then basically you have a let's say this is y. So if you have a flux, then you have a connection like in that direction, and that corresponds to just shift k by k minus a. So this is the 2D. And then if we compactify, it become a 1D Hamiltonian. And it basically become kx and as a function of theta. So we can just replace ky minus ay by a parameter we call theta. So we say we are interested in topological terms. Well, there may be some coefficients between them which I didn't take care of. Let's say this is just flux. Okay. So, sorry? I think that's true. Yeah, I mean we are not summing over the different momentum. Yeah. Or another way is saying so we are just interested in picking a special momentum. And if you pick different momentum, that just corresponds to different theta parameters. Yeah. Yeah. So we now have a 1D system, which is just a 1D chain. And on each side, you have two states. So it's a spinful 1D chain. Yeah. And then, what's interesting here is that we know the theta comes from the 2D gauge field. So the same calculation there can lead to a topological term which involves theta and the gauge field. Because in the 2D, you're calculating the bubble diagram, which is correspond to effective action a term like this. And now in 1D, we just replace this by the dashed line, which means a fluctuation of theta. And then correspondingly, you have a change of theta in the effective action. So we can see that, so what happened is, in the 1D case, the effective action as a function of A and theta, so I integral fermion with a fixed background theta and fixed background gauge field. And then I expand A and theta around some background to see its effective action. Then in the 2D case, remember what we get is this. And then the coefficient is the integral of F A X Y. And then now, so we just replace one A by theta. And then what we get is this. And then the coefficient also changed. But remember that this model and this model is, I mean, for a fixed momentum, they are the same. So the only difference in the coefficient is you have one less integral. So now I have just integral over kx and fx theta. So where fx theta means the curvature in the space of kx and theta. I just replace ky by theta. So nothing really changed if you consider them as parameters. But now you have only one-dimensional momentum space. So the same diagram for 1D system is just integral over the momentum. Okay, so this is the effective action in the 1D, maybe with a coefficient of 2 pi. So basically we consider the case that, so your Hamiltonian is, so my second contact Hamiltonian is like this, right? So I integrate, let's say, in the momentum. So to write down the dependence, to write down the dependence on A and theta, we need to go back to the real space. So you have this H and P minus A, but you also have the theta dependence. So you just write down that Hamiltonian back to the real space, and then couple it to gauge field and the parameter. I mean, and the theta can depend on space time. And then I expand the theta around some background value. That's something very similar to that. But it won't be C1, because I'm not integrating over theta, so it won't be just an integer. And exactly what we get is a coefficient before the f, but that coefficient is like the theta term, right? That's a phase, and we will see what's that. I mean, like in 2D, we are just deriving what's the coefficient of transamic term. And here, finally, we just derive what's the coefficient of f. So then, basically, I mean, the problem of... Sorry? Yeah, exactly. The coefficient of that is this, right? So we'll see that what's that. And so basically the procedure is I have a Hamiltonian where the fermion couple to this and that, the two fields. And then I expand, I do a perturbation to these two fields. And I expand it according to A equals zero, but not theta equals zero. I expand to this theta equals theta t, and then expand around some fixed value. Which value I used in the bubble. Right? I need to use some theta in the bubble. And then plus the perturbation term. Basically something like this. And then that gives you this this bubble. So then the interesting thing is that if we integrate the curvature over two coordinates, then you get an integer, which is a number. But what happens if you integrate only one coordinate? Then you actually get a derivative of the polarization, which is like this. So we know that you integrate over dkx, and if we integrate also over theta from 0 to 2 pi, so if we do two integrals, then this gives you 2 pi times the integer, which is the Schoen number. But that means this thing as a function of theta can be written in this way, partial theta of something. I mean, it must be part theta of some phase, because when you integrate over from 0 to 5, you always get an integer, right? So that's like a phase of a vertex. So, and it turns out that you can write P1 explicitly as this, put 2 pi here. You can write P1 explicitly as the flux of that A, which I mean the trace of the Barrier curvature, A, X, D, K, I. So that's just the flux in the 1D Brayton zone, 1D momentum space. So this is a space which belongs to U1, right? Because when you do gauge transformation, it's only invariant under up to 1. So this physically, this is just the charge polarization of the 1D system. To see that, you can go back to the definition of A, which is minus A and K, partial K and K, integral over dK. And this is just the coordinate operator. Exactly. So it means when you drive the, yeah, when you change the flux, you are changing the parameter theta. And then due to the Hall effect, you drive a current. And if I think the theta not as the flux, but as some parameter in 1D space, I'm pumping something through. Yeah. Yeah, so then we go, yeah. Oh, okay. So then the interesting thing is if you go back here, then you find that this, remember, this is partial theta of P1. P1 is a function theta. And then you put this and this together, you find that I can write down this as and the integration by part you get. And this is the coefficient of F. It means it won't be theta, because theta is just a parameter in my Hamiltonian. It depends on how I parameterize. But P1 is determined by my Hamiltonian. It's a physical quantity. So it's this. Oh, you mean if it's an open boundary? Yeah, so let's assume it's a spherical boundary. And if it's open boundary, the boundary term will tell you there are half charge, or there are fractional charge on the boundary. Because, I mean, it's like you consider the outside as something with a huge gap, and the huge gap just corresponds to theta equal to zero here. I mean, p equal to zero. I mean, when your gap is huge, then everything is localized. You calculate the barrier phase curvature is all zero, so then the p will be zero outside. Yeah, so that will be the physical consequence. So now we have the effective action of the 1D system. And what's the physical consequence? You just take the equation of motion, the variation of this over the electromagnetic field, then we get this Goldstone Wheel-Track formula. We get J mu equal to epsilon mu nu partial nu P. P1? Yeah. So means if my theta is gradually changing, then P1 as a function of theta is also space-time dependent. Then you will see there are some, for example, the charge equal to partial F of P1. Which means if you have a finite system, then the outside is equivalently P1 equal to zero. So this is my system. So then the P1 will be non-zero here and zero outside. And then there is a gradient here, so the charge will be non-zero on the boundary. And then when you change it in time, the charge is changing, which comes from the current pump. So the Euro goes on Wheel-Track formula. Where Goldstone and Wheel-Track wrote, that's like this. So they write this for the Dirac model, and the Dirac has the Dirac model, which is like kx sigma. In letter spaces, it's like kx sigma x. So I just expanded this model around the around k equals zero. Then you see that it's kx sigma x plus sine theta sigma y cosine theta sigma z. I mean, so that's the case. If there is a coefficient here, if the mass goes to zero, then that's the case that you take that continuum limit of that model. Then in that limit, P1 theta is exactly just theta over 2 pi. And that's why they get that model. They get that result. So this is just to show that this has nothing to do with, like, Lorentz invariance or anything. It's just for any lattice model, you have this kind of formula. Okay, so the last thing for 1D is we see this again looks like a transcendence theory in phase space. I mean, now in the real space, it's not a transcendence theory, it's a topological term in F. But if we write down this expression for P1 explicitly, then you get S equal to integral over dk, and then and another two integrals, the other two integrals, S and T, and then F, the AX, I mean the trace, it's just abelian, A, which is the KX component. And then you have the partial, you know, A mu. And this is the transcendence term. And the interesting thing is the coefficients are all correct. And if you write down it in the phase space, which is three dimensions, this is three dimensions. So it's a transcendence term. In this case, it's not so trivial because because the capital A is always only defined on the real space. So we have a phase space which we call Tx and Kx, and the capital A always only have these two components, and this is zero. But now the small a does not only have momentum space component, because if the theta is space dependent, theta is changing in the time, in the space, then the small a also have a space dependence. That's why you have this partial nu of p1. So the small a is dependent on all three of the coordinates. So that's why this is not a trivial expression now. Theta. Yeah. If you consider theta as just something fixed by your band structure, then you don't take derivative to that. But if you consider theta as a dynamical field, the small a. Yeah. But the small a is determined by your wave function, and the wave functions are determined by your Hamiltonian. So physically, taking derivative to that is actually changing this parameter theta in your Hamiltonian. I mean, physically, that's done by tuning some parameter in your Hamiltonian. And then, if you consider this data as dynamical, like it comes from some mean field, then you can do that. Then you get some current which covers this data, not current. It's, in this case, it's just some spin. Yeah. Yeah, so I think somehow here we keep both the real space and the momentum, and then this transcendence term kind of reduce that into that quantum power. I mean, if you write down a wave packet dynamics in this in that case, it will be the same as the quantum power case. You will see the x and y not commute, and they do that. Yeah. Yeah, I think in the quantum Hall case, that's equivalent. It doesn't contain more than that. I mean, because all the integral in the momentum space, it just give you that true number in before. So once you know that number, then it reduces. Okay. That's when you have interaction. I mean, if you don't have interaction, these are all for the case where you have a brain zone. For example, when you have a magnetic translation symmetry and you have a lattice, and the magnetic field is commutative, so that you have a magnetic brain zone. Otherwise you have to do the case boundary condition. But more so far we only have the generalization for the case where momentum is a good quantum number. Okay, so these two are giving simplest examples which are in low dimension, so it's easy to understand. And then we can easily just do parallel things in high dimensions. And so the reason why, I mean, we are interested physically, part of the motivation of this work is the discovery of this 3D plus 1D topological insulators. And so, we go to 4 plus 1 before going to 3 plus 1. That's because it's quite easy to guess what happened in 4+1 because we know there is a second chain number and you can write down the second chain term. So we can easily guess the topological term. But then you can prove by you can prove by the same way that it really works. You integral the fermion to do this, and then you see in 4+1. The effective action is just I think something like this. And there is the coefficient C2. And in the same way, I mean, the C2 is expressed exactly in the same way as this, which is, I mean, this kind of G inverse partial G to the power 5. I mean, in 3D, in the common Hall case, it's 2 to the power 3, now in 2 to the power 5. So the power 4 is 0. And so you have to have all number of powers and then trace it. So you show it as topological, and then finally it's reduced to this second chain number. So this is in the momentum space. So notice that now this is a bit centered here. You need to have an M, M, N. All the trees are for only occupied bands. That's why it's non-trivial. If you trace all the bands, it's always zero. Yeah, this is for the case when you have both momentum and the frequency. So if I write separately, it's this. Yeah. And you do the integral, you go back to this. They also yeah. Otherwise, I think without trace, it's already zero. I mean, if you go over all the bands, F is zero. Yeah. Because what you do is the Hamiltonian. What the Hamiltonian do is just rotate in the Hilbert space to have a momentum-dependent rotation. That's always pure gauge. So all the non-trivial things come from project out some of the bands. So okay. So in this case, it's clear that we just get the Shenzhen's term with this coefficient. And then what physical phenomena that correspond to is you just take the equation of motion and you get times this number. This is integer. What does that mean? It means that if we have, so this is 4+1D system. And then if we have a boundary, which is 3+1D in our world, then when I have a E and B, so that there is a current driven perpendicular to both of them, and then you this basically if you take these coordinates to be our physical coordinates, and this to be the additional one. Well, they are in the ADS, although this is not. But yeah, so you can take it in this way. That then you become E dot B, maybe divided by 4 pi square. So this is the current going out of our universe. So that tells you that you have an actual anomaly. And the number, the C2 basically tells you number of left minus number of right on the boundary. So in this way, we see that if you write down the fermion, so I have a free fermion Hamiltonian in the 4+1. And then you calculate the number, you get an integer. And then if that integer is non-zero, that means on the boundary, there must be chiral fermion. And there are more left movers than right movers, and they give you the correct anomaly agrees with this. So in some sense, the fermion theory and this theory is like dual to each other. I mean, they gave the same physical response. They agree with each other. So the interesting thing is that this is different from the first quantum Hall, the quantum Hall of the first transaminants. This transaminants break the time reversal. and this second Shenzhen is another break time reversal. So you can see it from this formula. The first, the common hall is like J proportional E, and E is time reversal even, and J is time reversal odd. So it breaks time reversal, and here you have a B, so it doesn't break time reversal. And that's alternative. So if you could look at the third Shannon number, it breaks time reversal. And then, so that's why it can be related to time reversal invariant physics in 3+1 dimensions. Okay, and then by the way, in the same way, if you put this definition here, you see it's a Shenzhen term again. ADA, put it here. So it's ADA, and two small f. So it's like A wedge F, wedge small f, wedge small f. Plus other term. In the phase space, which is 9 dimensions. So yeah, so then once we do this, then we can follow the same way as from 2+1 to 1+1. We can reduce it to the 3+1D topological insert. And then we can even follow the same model here to write down the model which give you an non-trivial Chern number. And that's the Dirac model. And that turns out to be true in any dimension. You write down a Dirac model with a mass, and then you change that mass, you tune the, you make the mass momentum dependent, and that can always give you a fermion. And so the 4+1D fermion has something like sine k. Something like this. So then if you reduce, you just replace the 3+, replace one momentum by theta. So I replace k4 by theta, which is actually k4 minus a4 by theta. And then, so you just get I equal to 1 to 3 sine ki gamma I. And you see you get something like this. This is exactly the two mass terms for the 3+1D fermion. So the time reversal invariant mass term and the gamma 5 mass term. I forgot to draw the diagram. So here in the Feynman diagram. So in that case, you integral fermion, you get a topological term which is quadratic. So that you can obtain from a two-leg diagram, a bubble diagram. And here, this calculation, I mean, we have the same bubble diagram, but that does not give you any topological term. It's just Maxwell. And then here you have this topological term, which is in third order of A, and that comes from the diagram, which is just the triangle diagram. And then in the 3+1 case, it just replaced to this, which is just the known anomaly term in the triangle anomaly in the 3+1. So, and then we can, in the same way as that, we can write down what's the coefficient of that term. Yeah, I think here you always assume the gauge current is conserved. I mean, we don't have chiral symmetry because on the lattice you just don't have chiral symmetry. So we always break the chiral symmetry and keep the gauge symmetry. Yeah. And yeah. And the and in the 3+1, what we get is so we have. We follow this one and replace one by theta. So we just get A nu, you know, theta. And then there is a coefficient. And now the coefficient is the same as the 1+1 case. It's the integral, but only over three momentums of the FY graph. Okay. And if you integral the four momentum is an integer, so now this is, again, a partial theta of something, which we call P3, is a polarization like thing in three dimensions, but that's a scalar, a pseudo-scalar. So then, again, we can write down, so the effective action of 3 plus 1 is this, and you take this and this, you get. And that's just P3, as I guess. So finally, you will see that if we take back all the coefficients here, I think this is like 32 pi squared, which make this an integer, and then make this an integer without boundary, and then the coefficient is like 2 pi p3, which is a phase. P3, we usually, because it's polarization, we design it as periodically 1. So 2 pi p3 is just a theta. So this is just a theta vacuum term with a theta equal to 2 pi p3. So what? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I forgot to write the expression. Yeah. So in the 1D case, this P is just a polarization. It's an integral over the. It's a flux. Right? It's an integral over the connection, and that's why it's a phase, because you do a large gauge transformation, you can change it. And here is the same. Because that is actually the zero string Simons term, and here the P3 is the string Simons term. That's because we know the FYGF is the divergence of string Simons term. No, in this case P is a charge polarization. In this case it's not. It's a magnetoelectric polarization. You can call it. I mean, you can call it a magnetoelectric polarization. Which means, yeah, I will explain it later. It's basically, it's not a polarization, but when you apply a magnetic field, you get a charge polarization proportional to it. That's because the physical meaning of P3 is a charge polarization at presence of magnetic field. So I will write that more explicitly. Fermi number conservation, you mean, or something flows to the boundary? I'm not sure because in this case, so this is again, this is 3 plus 1 is not this boundary 3 plus 1. It is like compactified the other direction. I mean, you take the periodical boundary condition and compactify it. That's 3 plus 1. So it's a non-chiral theory. Right? This is a non-chiral theory. It's 4x4. So the quantization, so the reason why P3 is a phase, so let me say two things. One is mathematically, so P3 is defined as, so you can use this to determine P3, and that's the integral of the transamic term in the momentum space. Ay dA plus AAA. So that's the integral in the momentum space. So that's why it's a defined modular some large gauge. I mean, when you do large gauge transformation, this can change that integer. And then physically the meaning can be seen in here. So let's say that's a very interesting thing that lead to all these predictions in 3 plus 1. So this is actually just P3 times some coefficient times e dot b. So that simply tells us that. Magnetic fields generate a charge polarization. Because if you have B times H, M dot B, then magnetic field generates a magnetization. So now this term just tells you have an M proportional to E. So then, that is actually M. The other way around is when you apply electric field, you generate a charge polarization which is proportional to B. So then you get charge polarization, which is P3 times B. And that's why P3 is defined modulo 1, because charge polarization can change, just like in the 1D case. Charge polarization is so physically, charge polarization is just the shift of your electron wave function away from the light side. Like everything shifts by a distance, then that's a polarization. And that's why it's defined as a phase, because if you shift by integer, you go back to the same system. I mean, the periodicity, yeah, the periodicity only applies when you have a compact gauge field and a lattice. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Otherwise, I think. I mean, from the effective theory, it seems more general, because the effective theory like this, you always, this P3 is always a phase, because this is the contact. Yeah, I think that's related to the interpretation. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think here you have a there is an analog here. Yeah, so So that's that's also another way to see the P3, why it's a defined modular integer. So let's see. So we have a so we have an effective action written in this way for pi. So I read in this, I write it in this way so that it looks more explicit that when you have a gradient of P3, you actually get a Hall effect, because that this is like a transform. When you have a P3 which jumps from here to there, then this 2D surface have a Hall effect. And then so now let's say if we take that model, and change and choose the correct parameter so this system is described by that model with the theta equal to pi, and that has P3 equal to pi, and then outside is vacuum, and that has P3 equal to zero, and then so now here if I take a gradually if I I change the P3 gradually, then you get this half factor. And you see the Hall connection is like gradient P3 over 4 pi. But this is in the 3D unit. It has a gradient. And to get the 2D, you just integrate across the surface. And then you just get the change of P3 over 4 pi. Over 2 pi. Yeah. So that means if the P3 is it's half. If it's half here, zero, zero there, then you get a half Hall connector. So that's one way to, it can be other values for this purpose. We will see later what's special for half. But anyway, so when P3 has a jump, then we see a Hall connector. But if I change the boundary condition here without changing anything in either side, I just add something on the boundary. And then I can add a 2D Dirac model, which we wrote earlier. Here, we can add such a 2D system here, and that will add a Hall connection 1. That will give you an integer change. So this can change by any amount. over 2 pi. So that tells us that if we only look at the box without specifying what happens on the boundary, we don't know the P3, we just know P3 modulo 1. So then that's related to Eduardo's question. Means if you allow interaction, then you can add a half on the here, right? You can add a more real space. But then in that case, you are actually allowing more generic situation. So that's not included here, and that's because the definition of P3 we wrote, which is the integral of the transamp term, that is only true for non-interaction fermion. So more generically, it may be possible to allow. I mean, here we haven't talked about time reversal symmetry, and when you have time reversal symmetry, then for the non-interaction fermion, you only allow two values of P3, which is 0 and 1/2. And when you have interaction, you may allow more values due to this argument. Yeah. So now let me say why the time reversal symmetry give you a Z2 classification and give you only two P3 values. So that's very simple because P3 is a phase, and if we say 2 pi P3 is a phase on the on the circle. And you can simply check that under time reversal is odd, because it's a coefficient. I mean, because you can see it in this equation, it's a Hall connection. So it's odd. So that under time reversal, P3 become -P3. Then if you give me a condensed matter system which has time reversal symmetry, then I must have this equation. But because P3 is only well-defined modulo integer, so this doesn't mean it's trivial. It just means there are two possible values, 0 and 1/2. So that gives you the Z2 classification that basically reduces U1 to Z2. And that tells us that in any three-dimensional insulator, we define a P3. And if the insulator is time reversal invariant, if the ground state is unique, then you just have two possible values. And that immediately tells you the topological difference between them, because this value cannot gradually change. So you have to have a phase transition between this and that. Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is the consequence of that action. I mean, Hall connection is out, so it's out. I mean, that's a special thing. I mean, that sounds like a strange, right? So we say that P3 can be 1/2 for a time reversal invariant system. And 1/2 means if you have a topological insulator with P3 1/2 and outside is 0, then you always get a half Hall connection, because this gives you the half Hall connection, modular integer time this. So how can that happen? I mean, because that break time reversal, right? You have a Hall connection on the surface that break time reversal symmetry. But that's possible because when you do this, you assume a interpolation between 1/2 and 0. And that detail of that interpolation breaks time reversal and determines the exactly what's the Hall connection. It means I have, in the box, I have P3 equal to 1/2. And the surface, I have 0. But I can do an interpolation in this way. I can also do an interpolation in this way, because I don't know if 1/2 or -1/2. It's like a winding this way or that way. So that means what break time reversal is the boundary condition. What if you don't break time reversal on the boundary? If you just insist to keep the time reversal symmetry everywhere, then you have a singularity between this situation and that situation. And then that tells you that you have to have gapless modes on the surface, because otherwise you gradually change from 1 to 1/2 to 0. Then if you gradually change from 1/2 to 0, you have to generate such a Hall connection. So the only way is you jump, and you across a singularity, which corresponds to a monopole in the momentum space. And that makes that the number which is always quantized, that's now it's not quantized. And that jump corresponds to gapless surface states, and the surface states can easily see what's the surface state from that correspondence of 4+1. Because this is like I reduce from the 4+1, I replace one momentum by a parameter, then I go to 3 plus 1. And then if you have yeah, that's also a possibility. That's very interesting. And because that's the only thing it can do, I mean, the only two things that it can do is spontaneously become superconducting or become spontaneous break time reversal symmetry. So that's actually more likely than usual from Uniquely, because usually you have other possibilities. But here you just have these two, so it can break time reversal spontaneously. Yeah, that is the current Hartree. Yeah, and now we are, so basically, yeah. So this is the current Harvey where we have 4 plus 1, and then the boundary is 3 plus 1. And the relation to this effect is not like this is our physical system, because this will be chiral. And the relation is that I compactify another direction. I compactify this direction, and then it becomes, so this is my box, 3 plus 1, and the boundary is 2 plus 1. And then what happened is, the surface that is here is just chiral fermion, sigma dot p, with the Hamiltonian of sigma dot p, is the chiral fermion. And then when I do dimensional reduction, I just reduce the one momentum to zero, then I just get a 2D Dirac fermion, 2 plus 1 Dirac, which is this. I mean, because I require time reversal symmetry, so I have to reduce the third momentum to zero. Otherwise, you break time reversal. So here you see, I mean, so this is a chiral fermion, and we know it's stable. It's topologically stable edge state, because there is no way to give it a mass term unless you have an anti-chiral fermion. And then why this is stable? I mean, in general, it's not stable because you can get a mass term, but the mass term break time reversal symmetry. So that's why it's stable when you require time reversal symmetry. But if you have two copies of it, then it's not stable. That's because there is no chirality in the 2 plus 1 dimension. So you don't have no-go theorem. So no chirality means if you have two copies of it, you can always think of it as like one chiral and one anti-chiral. You can always open a gap between them. So that's why it's D2. So this is a point of view from bulk, and this is a point of view from boundary, so they will agree. And then when you allow to have an interpolation between the bulk, between the topological insulator to the vacuum, between 1/2 and 0, then you have to break time reversal. And on the boundary, that corresponds to give a mass to this theory. And then you get half Hawking effect. And that's exactly the parity anomaly in 2 plus 1D. So it's always like, in the bulk, you have a topological theory, you have a topological insulator, then that guarantees you have some stable edge state on the boundary. But that stability depends on which class are you in. So in the 3 plus 1, it's only stable when you require time reversal symmetry. So it's kind of a restricted topological classification. And then the topological effects always lead to some anomaly on the boundary. So in 1 plus 1 is the chiral anomaly, 3 plus 1 is the actual anomaly, and 2 plus 1 is the parity anomaly. Okay, so I'm nearly finished. But the last part is about the general discussion. So first of all, let's see, it's easy to see that this is, again, a transcendence term in the phase space. Because, I mean, you can write this as P3 times FYJ, and P3 itself is the transcendence. That's right. AYTA plus AAA. So you multiply this with that and integrate over 7 dimensions, and that's the phase space transcendence term. So the interesting thing is, no matter whether you are in even dimension or odd dimension, the phase space is always odd dimension. Okay. So then we can see that in any dimension, we can write down the phase-space transition theory. And you can actually, in this way, you can prove that in any dimension D, D plus 1, I integrate out fermions. So this is D plus 1 dimension. Space time, D plus 1 dimension. And I get an effective theory. And the effective theory contains a term, contains a topological term. It contains a topological term like this. The transformance term in 2D plus 1 dimension of small a plus capital A. And small a is defined, I mean, of course this is only for the band insulator, for a massive free fermion. And then the small a is defined as the Barry phase curvature. And then this is the transformance term in 2D plus 1, and then I integrate over D momentum and this one? Yeah. This is identity, yeah. This is identity in the banding map. And actually, I mean, following the same calculation, you can also generalize A to capital A to non-abelian if you require that non-abelian gauge symmetry here. I mean, you just take two flavors of that and couple it to SU2 gauge symmetry, the same calculation follows. Because the it means this. So basically the logic is like this. So I have a Hamiltonian, which is smoothly dependent on space time. So locally I consider it as translation invariant. I mean this smooth is well defined because it has a gap. It's just the spatial version of 80 by 360. So it's smooth and once you know it's smooth then it's locally you have a momentum space, and then I can define the space and P. But in large scale, it's mostly depend on space time, so it also depends on space time. So basically, you consider momentum, coordinated time, all as parameters. And then I solve, for example, the 4x4 problem or 2x2 problem, then I get a wave function at several bands. And then I can define the A in this way. Partial. So the partial can be over momentum or space or time. So that's the generic phase-space definition. And the capital A is always only, the capital A in the phase space is always just the capital A in the real space-time and the zero. Does not have phase-space coordinates. But because the small a is defined over the whole space, so they have non-trivial mixing. So this term appears as a topological term in the effective action. And that when you expand, you get all the different topological terms. And that corresponds to all the possible topological phenomena in this given dimension. So, yeah. Yeah, exactly. When you do the dimensional reduction like that, from 4 plus 1 to 3 plus 1, it's like the descending equation, and actually, then you can go from 3 plus 1 to 2 plus 1, and in that case, you get a quantum spin Hall insulator from that 3D topological insulator. And the interesting thing is, just like the descending equation, it works only these two steps. So you can do further by this theory, but it does not lead to topological classification. So in all the dimensions like 2 plus 1, 4 plus 1, you have a topological insulator, and then it has two descendants. Which are topological insulator with some fixed discrete symmetry. Yeah, so let's take we can take an example of 2 plus 1 D, which is the quantum Hall case. And if you write down this theory, that's the second transformance like this. Five dimensional, 2Q. And then you get A plus A, A plus A. Let's plus the non-abelian terms. And then so you expand it, you see there is a term like this, A, B, A, B small a. there is no term like AD, AD, A, that's zero. This is zero because A only has three components. So this is zero. And the leading term is this. And then there is a second term. And then there is a third term. So these three terms describe three different phenomena. I mean, in a generic system, you get all the three terms, but some of them may vanish. For example, if you have time reversal symmetry, this vanishes because it's a quantum Hall, right? It vanishes. And this corresponds to quantum spin Hall effect. It does not directly tell you like spin Hall conductance because that is not well defined. But it tells you that, so if you take equation of motion, I will just very briefly say, if you take equation of motion, you get J equal to something like that. But this is four dimensions and you integrate over two momentum. So this is a two form and you deal with. So basically you get J mu equal to epsilon mu nu tau of some two form. So this is very similar to quantum Hall. So finally, it turns out that this two form is also exact. I mean, it's also like a curvature. So you can write it in this way, like this. So the only difference from quantum Hall is now this A is not the external electromagnetic field, but a bare-faced curvature. So what does that mean is in quantum Hall, in a quantum spin Hall, on the edge of quantum spin Hall, you can apply a magnetic field to break time reversal symmetry so that the edge state is gapped. Just like in the 3D case, when you allow a mass term, that break time reversal symmetry and gap it. And if that mass term has a domain wall, then you get, according to the Goldstone-Wilczek formula, then you get a half char here. And that phenomena is described by this equation. You can check that in that case, this A has a flux here, so that there is a charge rho corresponding to the flux. So that's how it describes different topological phenomena. And this is like a pure transcendence term, which doesn't respond to any external field. So only when you consider like the theta is dynamical, like the band structure itself is dynamical, then you have some quantum correction from this the Western Minervian term. Yeah. So in any dimension, you can do this expansion, and you get maybe, I don't know, 2D plus 1 or some terms. And the last thing I will show is just the tree of the topological insulators from the descendant. So you have a 0 plus 1, 2 plus 1, 4 plus 1, 6 plus 1. So all these are the dimension where you define Chern numbers. And then you write down the transcendence. I mean, you expand in the transcendence term, you get the Chern number contribution. I draw it on the trunk means it's topologically stable. I mean, it gives you a topological insulator which is stable without depending on any discrete symmetry. I mean, quantum Hall is well defined without any symmetry, but it actually requires charge conservation. Any of them has two descendants. It can go more. It can go more until somewhere here. You can do this expansion and you get all the different, and in each is a topological term. Here you have this 2 plus 1, you have this ADA, this is a quantum Hall. And this one you got ADA, this one is just a small A. This is really. Maybe, yeah. I mean, you just remove the external, external A. Oh yeah, this is directionally time-reversing environment. This is directionally time-reversing environment. this direction. So basically, if you don't require discrete symmetry, then the only thing defined, the only topological classification comes from here, because like if you go to 3 plus 1, you define some. This is 3 plus 1. If you go to 3 plus 1, you define a polarization, which is a phase, right? So that does not give you a classification. It's connected. The manifold is connected, the U1. But if I require T, then the phase, the U1 becomes Z2, and there is a Z2 here. And in the same way, if you do it again, you find this, there is a Z2 here. But there is no more. I mean, there are topological phenomena. Like this one is described by the transaction, like ADA, DA, DA. So it's just the notation. And then the Z2 in this 2 plus 1, you remove one capital DA, you just get ADA, DA, which I just showed that there. And then in the 1 plus 1, you get a small ADA. Then you are done, you cannot reduce again. So, and that is a topological, that corresponds to some topological phenomena, just like this term. But it does not give you a classification. It means you cannot give me a material, I calculate something, and I give you a discrete value. That's only true for these two. And for all these, that's true. And the interesting thing is that, like, in different dimensions, you need to use different symmetries. So here you need to use a particle symmetry to define the topological, to define a discrete topological environment. Because in 1D, the charge polarization is time-reversal even. So you cannot use time-reversal to restrict the U1 to Z2. You have to use something which is odd, which changes the charge polarization. That's particle hole transformation. So if you require the system to be particle particle invariant, then you reduce this U1. This is the U1 value of the polarization to 2 values, 0 and 1/2. And that's why you have a Z2 here. And in the same way, in 0 dimension. Yeah, I'm done. So I just mentioned the last thing that that the time reversal in this dimension turns out to be different. Because T square is minus 1 here and plus 1 here. And so you get the periodicity of 8. And the 9 plus 1 is the same as 1 plus 1. That's also one interesting thing to know. Okay, I'm done. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, if we forget about the phase space, and just look at the special effective actions like FYF, then we can think that we can imagine that even for interacting system, it's well defined. And the coefficient of it is a physical quantity which is well defined. And we can have some general argument that why it's a phase, why the U1 phase and these things. But I don't have a phase space discussion for interacting system. I mean, we cannot simply replace momentum by twist boundary condition because the many body system, at least in this sense, at least the non-interacting system, always has a unique ground state. So if you use twist boundary conditions and study the many-body wave function, it only gives you some abelian benefits. So it's not directly generalized in that way. That's the problem. Yeah. 2 plus 1, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely possible that there are these. So another hint is here, means that So there is an argument that give me a time reversal invariant system, T3 is always 0 or 1/2. And that's because it must, when you do time reversal, it can only change by integer. And physically, why it can only change by integer? Because the boundary Hall connection can only change by integer, and by adding some quantum Hall on it. But if you consider interaction, that's not true. So it can also change by some fraction. So that means in the interaction case, we should have some more generic classification. But it is well defined, and because you apply magnetic field and measure charge polarization, and that's the coefficient between them. It's always a physical quantity. Yeah, that is, we don't have a theory about it, but it's definitely a direction of going to.